Okay. And we are live. All right, so this week's Parsha. Parsha's what? Anybody know? This is I'm starting easy here, guys. This is the warm-up pitch. Hey, Jonathan Brody, all right, from Syosset, New York.
Hi, Sarah.
All right, Chai Sar is correct. Well done. Chai Sar is correct. Just a quick basic question, what are the two basic episodes that occur in this Parsha? What else we got here? Anybody? All right. Go ahead.
Mark?
Semantics again.
Can you hear me?
Now I do. I hear you now.
Oh, okay. I said Sarah dies.
Sarah does die. That's one pasuk. It's one verse. But the main part of it is about the burial and negotiation of the plot. What else? A big chunk of the parsha, like 67 verses, psukim.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Oh, Mark has raised his hand using the mark. All right, Mark, what's the answer?
Rebecca and Isaac meet.
That's right. Which Mark is this? Who just answered that?
Brody.
Oh, you came up as a who? I guess Mark didn't do it. Okay. All right.
My middle name is Isaac, and Beth's middle name is Rebecca.
Ooh, look at that. Well done. What a Parsha tie-in that is. All right, so you have two chunks of the Parsha. You have the burial of Sarah, the negotiation for the plot, and then you have 67 verses talking about Avram dispatching his servant, which, according to the rabbis, is Eliezer, and getting of the whole episode of getting Rivka, and that's essentially the major chunks of the Parsha. And then, of course, that's the basic deal. All right, so I'm going to go to a share screen. We're going to get the Chai Sar class. Does everybody see the class sheet? All right, good. So the title of the class is What Makes the Maarat HaMachpelah, which is the Cave of the Patriarch, so special? A little context. I think nearly everybody has, most people on this call, has been to Israel with MJE. If that's true, give me a head shake. Okay. Good. And I know I've taken a number of you with the fellows, and I know I'm going to take a number of you coming up. So one of the highlights of the trip, we go to the town of Hebron. We go to the army base. We'll deliver goods, you know, some treats to the soldiers. At least one platoon of 88 young men. We actually, this year we took it to the next level. We sent them all kinds of gear with their unit's logo and design, so they'll have something to remember us and each other, because after a certain cycle of time, like a year, then they get put into different other units and they'll separate out to other parts of the country. So We had a little joy in their lives, and as you know, if you're watching the Israeli news, that's been a rather hot spot in Israel, and those guys are they're real schwitzen, because there's a lot of tension there. So after we go to the army base, we always go to the Cave of the Patriarch, Maarat HaMachpelah, okay, and I want to share with you a little. Personal dimension here. When I go to the Maarat HaMachpelah, and we'll typically go daven there, I get it, sort of like my inner elementary school self, and everybody has that elementary school self that is always bubbling around and expressing themselves, and we try to edit it out and try to direct it properly. But my initial sense that elementary school says, oh, we're going to daven here, And that field is going to shoot right to Shemayim. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be first on line in front of the heavenly throne. And, you know, which is a feeling, you know, it's a special place. You know, you think you're going to, special place, special davening place, definitely going to be answered. So, but then I think to myself, that's a, you know, that may not how be it works, because I'm going to share a little view, we're going to go to a little YouTube situation. There are situations where prayers are answered, and unfortunately there are times that prayers are not answered, and it's, the whole area of prayer is not a simple thing. And it's not simple as just going to a special place where you go, bing, the davening, you know, welcome to the tefillah zone, my tefillah will be answered. It's not as simple as that. So I'm going to go to with our first video, as we like to do. Get into the zone. All right.
War was to become the fate of a generation of Jews living in Palestine, the land of Israel. They, and often their parents, were people who had struggled and built for half a century, inspired by a dream of Jewish sovereignty. And they were to be joined by Jews from Arab countries, and by those who had survived the European tragedy and longed for a homeland free from persecution.
Egypt? No. Soviet Union? Yes. United Kingdom? Abstained. United States? Yes.
Resolution of the Dutch Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstained.
At the end of the Second World War, the Jews of Palestine were determined to establish a state, the first manifestation of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel for 2,000 years. On the 29th of November, 1947, the United Nations voted to establish two states, one Jewish, one Arab, in a partitioned Palestine. The Arabs swore to resist the creation of a Jewish state, even by war. This film is the story of that war.
Okay, so what I wanted to bring up here is that you see the vote, and then, of course, on May the 5th, 1948, there's a vote again to recognize the State of Israel. Now, I need to share with you that, you know, the Jewish people have been, as a unit, in our prayers, have been davening for sovereignty of Israel for 2,000 years. So I need to share with you that, which I can't really do, but I've spoken to people who were there, the sense of elation, especially after the travail of the Holocaust, about the birth of the State of Israel was, for so many people, a sense of literally it was a divine gift. The prayer had been answered. There was a state of elation, a sense of Jewish pride that surrounded the entire world was simply unbelievable. Again, you're talking about 3 years after the Holocaust for the Jews that were for the majority of the Jews that did not know the extent of the horror of the Holocaust and losing 6 million Jews. A mere 3 years later that they have their own sovereignty in a place where at least they can go and determine their own future was to say that it was a tefillah answered would be a profound understatement. So you can experience that tefillah will be answered. I would also say the experience of the Six-Day War also, because there was a tremendous fear that there was going to be another Holocaust and that both the Egypt, the Jordanians, and the Syrians would be successful in their desire to throw all the Jews into the sea. And when that would turn around, that was also a really prayer answer. I want to go to another video. Let's go to another video. Is that clear? Guys, is that clear? A good example of a tefillah answered? the sense of a prayer being answered. Okay. Share screen. Okay. Now, this is Rahele Frankel. Does everybody, who knows who Rahele Frankel is? Anybody know?
Her son was
one of the... Yeah, anyone.
Sorry. She's the mother of one of the three Yeshiva boys that were killed last summer.
Right. So her now is coming up to a year and a half ago already. Her son, Naftali, was one of the three boys that were abducted and were murdered. This video is taken from the time when where they did not know what had happened to them, okay? And she speaks about her thoughts about the matter. It's quite impressive. So let's go to the videotape.
It is true that the three families are believing people. Faith has a very strong part in our lives. But I think within this experience, we're first and foremost parents. We miss our boys terribly. We're afraid, we're anxious, whatever. That's where we're coming from. Prayer is very powerful, but it's not a guarantee for anything. Just because I'm praying with all my heart, it might help. I believe it could help, especially when thousands and millions of people are praying, and they are. But nobody owes me anything. And if tomorrow, God forbid, I'll hear the worst news, I don't want my children to feel, but where did all my prayers go? Okay? Basically, I feel that if I'll have to fall apart, I can always do it later. You know, if this turns out horribly, I won't be giving any interviews then. Right now, I'm very optimistic. We have every reason to believe that they're alive.
Okay. So, I think it's, that was a rather key point there. What was her point about tefillah? She had a very interesting attitude. This was taken at a number of days before they discovered the bodies. What was her attitude about prayer? She said, you know, tefillah is it helps, especially if many, many people are davening for that. But she had a signature line. What was the signature line? What, did you catch the signature line there? Who wants to share it?
She's saying nobody owes me anything? Or
yes.
Like, yeah. Yeah. I don't like that. I don't like that.
Right. So we don't like that, but it's interesting that even though that she felt very obviously distraught, but she said it in another interview. She said in a different way, but I think it brings the point a little bit clearer. God does not work for us. God does not work for us, which means that she was saying, and this was that, in other words, we're ignored that there is an institution of tefillah. It's an important institution, but it's not about that that tefillah is a tool of manipulating God and to give us what we want, when we want it. Because first of all, sometimes the answer is also no. And sometimes that answer, we don't really understand why the answer is no. Like, I'm sure she does not know why her son, I don't think anybody could articulate why her son and those two boys, who were, you know, as later merged, were phenomenal people, were just in the most ruthless manner, just killed. Not really, it's not subject to a clear knowing. We can't know this particular situation is an expression of divine justice. We have the assumption it is divine justice. We can't demonstrate that. That's a postulate that we assert. We don't. The Torah tells us that, but we can't clarify how that is. So she says, you know, her attitude is, and this is a extremely, I would call it a very mature perspective. Is that, God doesn't owe us anything, and therefore, He's not. He does not have to answer our. He does not have to answer our prayers. Obviously, it's not a thought that we like. But if we think about it, does God owe us anything? You know, He created us. You know, He doesn't have to. He doesn't answer our prayers. He doesn't have to. He does. He can. You know, with the state of Israel being example, 60 war thing example that he did. But unfortunately, it's not a guarantee. It's not a guarantee. So the reason why I'm bringing up that topic is because when we go to Maraso Machpelah, we've gone there, we do specifically go to Davin. And I think it's typically a very special tefillah experience. But it's not a... You know, even though I personally, the little boy in me wants to say, well, I'm davening here, you know, our tefillah is going to go shoot right up and be answered, and it's going to be awesome. So, I just think that her perspective is a much more, contrast to my little boy feeling, is a much more thoughtful perspective. Because we've all seen situations where people daven, it doesn't, you know, they don't get what they want. Doesn't work that way. God's not there to be manipulated. So I think that's, you know, how tefillah works is obviously a massive topic. But I want to share, and then the question rolls in, is that why did Avram create the Maraso Machpelah? Is it therefore, is it the, you know, get anything you want place, which my inner boy wants to believe it could be? We know that Avram... Did Avram have an... Let's look through the parshios. Would you say that Avram had an easy life? Who can point to things in Avram's life that were not easy? Give me one example. And you can shout it out. Just give me a situation which was not easy.
Being separated from Sarah twice in foreign lands.
Right, so they were... She was abducted twice. Right, good. Yossi, well done. What else?
I'm going to go with circumcision.
Okay, circumcision at age 99. Atcheroni. All right. Right, he had to, okay, John Brody just said 10 tests. He had to leave his homeland. He had to abandon his friends, his family, his business contacts, and go to a place that nobody knew him. That's rough. That's correct. The second trial, he shows up to Canaan. What happens there? He shows up to the land of Canaan. What does he get?
War of the Five Kings?
No, much before that. What else does he get? What happens when he shows up? Come on, guys. You've got to be looking over the Parsha here. It's a Parsha class. And this is not this week's Parsha. It's from 2 weeks ago. John and Brody going with an upset tummy. Now, he did not get an upset tummy because, well, he did in a sense because there was a famine. There was a famine. He shows up to Canaan and he gets a famine. That's why he has to go to Egypt. Now let me ask you a simple question. If most people, if God had directed any of us to go to the land of Canaan and we show up there and it's an absolute famine, what would most people do?
Complain or rebel.
Complain, rebel, and go home. Right, leave. John Brody again. Will you just leave? So, But Avram said, look, we're gonna go to Mitzrayim, we're going to go to Egypt, a temporary measure, and then we're going to come back. We're going to stick this thing out. Okay, so one thing is clear. Avram, one of the greatest humans of all time, he was a prophet, person who prayed to God, person God listened to, does not mean equal easy life. A relationship with God does not mean equal like, well... Everything I fantasize about will be given. Apparently, that's not how God runs the world, even for His beloved, the most beloved. So that's just a mature perspective. All right, so let's go into the actual parsha itself. Let's take a look at the parsha, and let's get into the text. All right, everybody see this sheet? All right, who would like to read? Take the first two psukim. Who would like to read? Any volunteers? Or I'm just going to volunteer somebody. Okay, we're going to go Danielle.
Sarah lived to be 127 years old. These were the years of Sarah's life. Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, also known as Hebron in the land of Canaan. Abraham came to eulogize Sarah and to weep for her.
Okay. One of the few times it openly says in the Chumash that, you know, a relative eulogized their wife or their... Obviously, it's a natural phenomena, but it's the Torah is highlighting it here. So I'm asking you a basic question. What is the goal of a eulogy? And the Hebrew word for eulogy is hesped. Hesped. What is the goal of a eulogy? What's a good eulogy? What makes a eulogy good? Anybody want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, I'm going to go with what makes a eulogy good. I think one of the things is that it's short.
Okay.
I'm being serious. Like, you can't go on and on.
Okay.
I'm saying this for a specific reason, because I went to the Torah class last night, so I don't know, the way we discussed it last night kind of...
Has shaped your thoughts. Well, going on because I would agree with you, because if you go on and on, typically you're going to lose your impact. You're going to dilute the point. But what do you obviously you want to be short, but you want to be too short.
But what I'm trying to get at is because of the particular people that were attending this funeral.
Right, the people of Chet, the people of the local tribes people. But
no, but weren't there like a lot of important like
dignitaries?
Yeah.
But I'm asking a more general question. I'm taking it out of the context of Avram, and I'm saying, in general, a eulogy in general, for anybody, in any circumstance, at any time, what is the goal of a eulogy? What makes a eulogy in general good? Who would like to take a...
Well, I think like a eulogy that captures the essence of a person, what they did with their life, what they stood for, something that tells you about what they did when they were alive and why they should be remembered.
100%. That's the excellent answer. A good eulogy distills the person's life, their values, their accomplishments, their virtues, and you express it in an emotional way via personal anecdote, examples, and you paint the picture of the core of the person and what the world will be missing because this person is no longer around. So if that person is a regular person, it will be, you know, it could be very, very short. But with Sarah, obviously we're talking about the mother of the civilization. That's why the Torah tells us that was... Avram came to eulogize Sarah and to weep for her. The main focus, his main thrust, of course he cried for her, but was to articulate and distill what was the essence of Sarah, what was her essential contribution, because not everybody would be aware of it. And also now that the mother of the Jewish people is now gone, how are we going to find our way moving on? Because really, half of the dream team is no longer around. And it was, you know, simply devastating. So that really is, the eulogy, it's a big mitzvah to what they call masbid kehalacha, to give a person, to eulogize a person in a proper way. You know what I'm saying? Oftentimes, I go to a lot of funerals as a rabbi. One of the perks of the job. And, you know, look, people don't really know what to do. So some people like want to distract the audience and they'll, you know, share lots of jokes and funny anecdotes. And there's a place for you can't make a joke, but oftentimes distracts from what really was their core qualities. And oftentimes the inner person is not really shared with the community properly. So it's something that, you know, a person, relative has to take, you know, great care in. And it's hard to do because it's usually in a time when you personally are very, very upset. It's not easy to do that. Okay, question number two. All right, Danielle, read question number two.
Moshe Rabbeinu's burial plot is hidden, and most of our greats do not have a special burial spot, such as the Marah. Why did Avraham make Sarah an exception to this rule?
So that really is a... If you go through Tanakh, all 24 books, we're not identified too many of the... we know the patriarchs are buried all in the Marat HaMachpelah. Yosef is buried in Shechem, unfortunately, recently the victim of arson. Moshe is specifically is hidden. We don't know where it was. And somewhere on the mountain of Nebo, in that area. The 12 tribes, we don't know. Aaron is buried in Hor HaHar. We don't know where that is, really. Miriam, don't know. A lot of the other people in the Navi, Yoshua, etc., we don't know exactly where they're buried. So apparently, Torah is not such an important element. But by, we'll see in the story here, Avraham makes a big deal about making, we're going to go into the story right now, makes a very big deal about creating this, cemetery for the patriarchs. So let's get into the actual story itself. Let's go. All right, Danielle, Bavakasha.
Abraham rose from beside his dead, and he spoke to the children of Hayt. I'm an immigrant and a resident among you, he said. Sell me property for a burial place with you so that I can bury my dead, not have her here right in front of me. The children of Hayt replied to Abraham, saying to him, listen to us, sir. You are a prince of God in our midst. Take our best burial site to bury your dead. No one among us will deny you his burial site to bury your dead. Avraham rose and he bowed to the local people, to the children of Hayt. He spoke to them and said, if you really want to help me bury my dead, put her out of my presence, listen to me and speak up for me to Ephron, son of Sohar. Let him sell me the Machpelah cave, which belongs to him, at the edge of his field. Let him sell it to me in your presence for its full price as a burial property. Ephron was then sitting among the children of Hayt.
Let's stop right there. So apparently... He gets up from eulogizing, and he speaks to the people who are right there, and he does something which is kind of strange. What does he start to do? Which is kind of weird.
He says he wants to buy a plot.
Right. Now, typically, most people you would imagine would want to do this in advance. Apparently, was Avram unaware that a woman of 127 years old might die soon? I mean, it's not exactly a mystery. It's kind of weird that he didn't take care of this earlier. But does he know where he wants to be buried? Her to be buried? So that's even more perplexing. He knows where he wants to be buried. He says, do me a favor, speak to, on my behalf, to this guy Ephron, who's part of your tribe. And I'd like to, specifically, him to sell me the Marat cave, this double cave, which is on the edge of the field. Let him sell it to me as a burial spot. Now, if he knew where she was best buried, why didn't he go over to Ephron, a year before, 5 years, 10 years? Why is he starting to negotiate now? Is this a good time to be negotiating real estate? What do you guys say? Jennifer, Cohen, you're going to go with no. It's not a good time. Why is it not a good time? You're on mute. I can't hear you. All right.
He needs it so they could name any place.
Right.
You don't have the most left when you really need something.
Right. If you want to, right. If you, right. Obviously, if you want to get it, if you want to get something at a relatively good deal, you don't demonstrate your absolute need for something and that it's really, and basically you'll pay any price here. So it's a very bad time to go shopping when you are desperate for a property. All right, let's keep on going, because that's a weird thing there. Let's keep on going.
Right. Ephron was then sitting among the children of Chet. Ephron the Chetite replied to Abraham in the presence of the children of Chet so that all who came to the city gate could hear. No, my lord, he said. Listen to me. I have already given you the field. I have also given you the cave that is there. Here, in the presence of my countrymen, I have given it to you. Bury your dead. Abraham bowed down before the local people. He spoke to Ephron so that all the local people could hear. If you will only listen to me, he said, I'm giving you the money for the field. Take it from me, and I will bury my dead there. Ephron replied to Abraham, saying to him, my lord, listen to me. What's 400 silver shekels worth of land between you and me? Bury your dead. Abraham understood what Ephron meant. He weighed out for Ephron the silver that had been mentioned in the presence of the children of Chet, 400 shekels, negotiable currency. Ephron's field in Machpelah, adjoining Mamre, thus became Abraham's uncontested property. This included the field, its cave, and every tree within its circumference. It was Abraham's purchase with all the children of Chet, who came to the city gate as eyewitnesses. Abraham then buried his wife Sarah in the cave of the Machpelah field, which adjoins Mamre, also known as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. This is how the field and its cave became the uncontested property of Abraham as a burial site purchased from the children of Chet.
Okay, so how would you characterize our good friend Ephron over here? Was he? He seems to be very polite. Please bury your dead. Very generous. And then he says, "You know, go bury your dead." What is? Then he throws up the line. What is 400 silver shekels of land between me and you? What is the intimation here? Anyone want, this is a classic, is Ephron being generous?
No, he's giving him the price.
But how is he doing it?
Subtly. Not so subtly.
Right, so he's, first of all, he says, now my lord, listen to me. I've already given you the field. I've also given you the cave. First of all, he adds to the deal. Abraham wanted to buy the cave, not the field. He throws in the field. He says, "I've given you the field. I've given you the cave in front of my countrymen. Bury her." Just in order, which it seems like he's what giving as a gift. He's being Mr. Magnanimous. And then Abraham doesn't want to take it for free. He says, "I'm going to give you the meal. I'm giving you the money for the field. Take it from me, and I'll bury my dead here." So then Abram says, oh, no. Then Ephron says, listen, my lord, what's 400 silver shekels? Bury your dead. Which means you don't have to give me the money now. So then, once he mentioned that, what did Abram do? What did Abram understand what Ephron meant? What was really going on there? A little negotiation going on here. Cat.
That was the praise.
Yeah, but why is he?
Several
circles. Yeah. So, but is Ephron being generous? Is Ephron being predatory? Is Ephron being? Before he seems to be saying, "I've given it to you." First thing I give it to you, then bury your debt, which implies you don't have to pay me, or you don't have to pay me now. And then Ephron says, "No, I'm going to give you the fee money." And then, oh, what's the 400 silver shekels? So was he going to give it away, or was he initially going to charge him?
He was always going to charge him. He was being a good businessman.
Right. So bottom line is he wanted to look like being Mr. Generous guy. So Rashi brings down the general rule: the wicked says much but does little, and the righteous say little, do much. Avram in last week's parsha. Said, I'm just going to give you some water for your feet and a little bit of bread, and then gave a big, robust meal. Ephron says, yeah, you can have everything. Don't worry about it. 400 shekels. Come in. Don't even worry about it. He heard that he really wanted the money, and if he wanted to have an uncontested purchase, he's got to, not just 400 shekels. What kind of shekels? In negotiable, what they call over la sucher, 400 pieces of silver that everybody in the world would accept as being a legitimate full shekel. So he wanted, you know, uber big, you know, the maximum price. This is our good friend Ephron. Now, after you just, your wife's sitting in state, is this a good time to have a negotiation?
I
If you're Efron, yes.
Right. So I returned to my question as what this was not a pleasant experience. What was Avram thinking? Avram's a smart dude. There's actually a strategy to Avram, what Avram's doing here.
He wanted to have the witnesses, have the whole town see it so they can't contest it later that he owned the field.
Okay, point number one, he wants to do it right now so everybody will be there to witness it. Correct, that's one point. But there's more. What else? He knew what he wanted, so why didn't he go to him, Efron, a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago? He's not a youngster himself.
Because he wanted to show sincerity of what he wanted it for, and he didn't also, to Yossi's point, he wanted everyone to see exactly what the purpose was he was using it for, and since his loved one just passed, he was clearly going to use it for that. There's no question. If he bought it a year before, people would have questioned his motives.
Good. And so you're saying that there would be reason that Ephraim maybe not have agreed to such a sale.
Right.
Correct. Now, it's interesting, the Sforno, I didn't bring it down on the sheet, says that in general, we see that in the Torah, that to sell your ancestral land, and that's true even to, is a very, something that person does really in the last, only if you're really down on your luck. It's true even in America. If you get the family land, you don't just sell it because you need a quick buck. You do it unless you're, when you're in a dire circumstances. So, what you could argue is that Avram had to wait till now. I'm piggybacking what Kat had to say here, is that he needed the force of the circumstance of a Sarah being dead. But that's not all. He also works with the townspeople of Chais. They act as ambassadors to speak to Ephron, to sort of say, hey, it's going to be all right because you're helping two great people. As he says, you're a princess of God in our midst. You're right over here. See that? Yeah, you're a princess of God in our midst. So they view him in a very exalted fashion. So they function as a coalition. They go to Ephron, and Ephron, of course, agrees. But, of course, Ephron, of course, in his special little way, extracts the full possible total cost that could possibly be squeezed for this particular property. Not only that, he sells him a little extra of his property, not only the cave, but the field as well, which Avram did not ask for. So the point is that Avram wanted this Maarat HaMachpelah cave, but he knew the drama of people there, the fact that Sarah's sitting in state, and to energized Ephron to agree to the sale. And apparently Ephron was quite happy to agree to the sale. So, okay. So, but again, one of my questions that we have, our main question for tonight, why is Avram making such a big deal of barrier anywhere? Why is he going through tremendous aggravation, especially in a time when you don't want to have aggravation? What is he trying to accomplish? And the Torah thinks it's significant. He tells you the whole play-by-play, which again is rare. The Torah is not big on giving all kinds of biographical information, which is not really relevant. So what do you guys say?
Because this is no ordinary person.
It is no ordinary person. Correct. But what is he trying to accomplish? What do you want? What are you trying to?
He wants to point out to the world that, like, this is an extraordinary person, and you should, like, she's the mother.
100%. In other words, in a certain sense, there's a positive part of it. There's a pro to a eulogy, and there's a con to the eulogy. The good aspect of the eulogy is that people can emotionally feel and be impacted by the what the person stood for. But the problem is, it's over. and the person is forgotten. So Avram felt that his wife Sarah, and by extension him, and his son, eventually Yitzchak, and his wife Rivka, and Yaakov and Leah, these people's impact on the world, there should be a place on the earth where their idea and ideals will be a monument to them. Not to pray to them, God forbid, but an opportunity to reflect upon their significance and their whole thing. And in fact, this is a super duper extra credit. Who went back? Who, according to the Midrash, went back to the Marta Machpelah later on in the Chumash? Okay, it's a tough one. Okay, but I have the answer right here. So, as you guys are familiar with, later on the Jews are about to enter the land of Canaan, and Moshe sends 12 spies. One of the spies was named as Kaleb ben Yefuneh. Him and his partner Yoshua turned out to be one of the good guys. All right, Danielle, the Vakcha, read the verse.
They went up in the south, and he came to Hebron, and there were Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of the giant. Now Hebron had been built 7 years before Zoan of Egypt.
Okay, so it says they went as a group for the south. They're doing their scouting. Okay, and then it shifts to a singular tense, and he went until Hebron. Okay, Rashi, this is Rashi, by the way. Keep it there. He came to Hebron.
And he came to Hebron. Caleb went there alone, hence the singular, he came, to prostrate himself on the graves of the patriarchs in prayer, that he not be enticed by his colleagues to be a part of their council. Thus it says, I will give him, Caleb, the land on which he has walked, and it is written, they gave Hebron to Caleb.
Okay, so Caleb apparently was feeling pressure to agree with the rest of the group of the spies, and give a bad report. So what does he do? He leaves them, according to the Midrash, and goes to the cave, to the cave of the patriarchs, and what does he do there? And this is what... Yeah, but is it a little kind of prayer?
No, he's on the ground.
Right, yeah. He is prostrating himself on the graves of the patriarchs in prayer. So according to the Midrash, he's having a very intense experience here. Now, he's not praying to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but so why does he have to go to the cave? Let him pray where he is. What is the cave adding to his prayer? Pray anywhere. Right? You can access Hashem anywhere. Whoa, Feedback City. All right. You got, whoever's trying to call, you got to put that on mute. All right, please don't put your boot on. We're getting some harsh feedback. Nice. All right. If you're calling in by phone, put yourself on mute because we're getting some massive feedback. Hold on, let's see if I can. All right. Nice. I got to get managed participants. Hold on. All right, I'm going to hold on. Hold on a second. Oh, I can mute people. This is awesome. They have this feature where I can mute people. This is awesome. This is awesome. If I don't like what you're saying or you're making some harsh feedback, I will mute you. All right. Anyways. Okay. So, all right. You know this new mechanism of teaching online? We're working on it. All right, so here we go. So the question is that here we have Kalev is feeling tension about, obviously, there's the other 10 members of the 12 tribes want to give a bad report, and as such, he is nervous that he's going to fall into their trap or give into their counsel. And he goes by himself. He makes a little detour. He goes to Hebron. He goes into the cave, and then he's engaged in prayer while prostrating himself on the graves of the patriarchs, which seems to be a little strange. Because can't you pray anywhere? You could pray at MJE. You could pray on the east side, the west side, Florida, Connecticut, Antarctica, Israel, Jerusalem, everywhere. Why do you like to go there? Yes, anybody want to take a stab?
He has some extra good juju around him now.
He's got some extra juju. Well, that's how I feel as a kid. I feel that you go to the Martha Machpelah, well, there could be some extra tefillah juju. You know what I mean?
So, yeah, I know.
Okay, so the point of the matter is that...
Is this a new technical term, tefillah juju? Because I got to use this.
Right, tefillah juju. It's a new one. So what I believe is happening here with Kalev, obviously God's glory is everywhere. He's not in a cave or outside a cave or anywhere. But what him going to the Marat HaMachpelah, to the patriarchs, allows him a unique experience of reflection. And not reflection on anything, but specifically what the patriarchs stood for. Specifically, there was a covenant between God and the patriarchs about giving them the land of Israel. And even though that the other members of the spies want to sabotage this, he takes the point to be there in the close proximity of their last physical remains and reflect upon what they stood for, how they cherished the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, what's a covenant, and by doing so, was energized in his prayer and his focus and his concentration. It allowed him a new perspective. Personally, when I go to the Marat HaMachpelah, and I daven Mincha, the words that have the most meaning to me is the first few words of the Amidah. When I say the word Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu, our God, Elokei Avoseinu, the God of our forefathers, and I say the word God of Avram, and there I am standing within, you know, a physical close proximity to where they are, God of Yitzchak, right there, God of Yaakov, that gives my focus, concentration, awareness, a qualitatively, it's an experience, but it's not the same as diving on 131 West 86th Street. I'll just tell you that. Because my focus upon the reality of the Avot is completely different. The Avot, in a certain sense, and what they stood for, come alive. And therefore, my thoughts about them are different. The quality of my tefillah is now different. And that, I believe, Kalev was able to go and stand against tremendous peer pressure of great men against the onslaught to sabotage the mission and come back with a bad report that the land of Israel is a bad place, it consumes its inhabitants, we can't invade it, it's a terrible idea, we got to turn around, we cannot do it, etc., etc., etc. And by doing so, he stood victorious. He wasn't able to convince anybody else, but he did not bend to the profound peer pressure. And that, I believe, is what Avram wanted to accomplish. I want to accomplish by creating a monument to the Avos, what they stood for, their ideals, and therefore it is very significant in tefillah. It is impactful in tefillah, not because it's going to magically shoot up into the tefillah shoot and go right to Shemayim, but rather is that my quality of my prayer is now transformed. I'm thinking about the prayer in a different way. I'm relating to Hashem in a superior manner. And therefore my tefillah is different, and therefore will be related to different. You know, what God does with it, I don't know. But the quality of the tefillah is of a different nature. And that's why Avram wanted to make the extra effort, even though his wife was sitting there, lying out there in state, and he goes through this very difficult and contentious negotiation with a shyster of a real estate guy. He ends up getting ripped off, but it's still worth it. And he does that so there should be a place where we can go to this very day and reflect upon, and by being in physical proximity to where they were buried, it has an impact. And in my experience, going on the MG Israel trip for the last 8 years, I don't think it really leaves anybody cold. I think it does have, each person's different, each person's a little bit different, but it has an impact. For some, it's the most important thing that happened in Israel. Some, it's not, but it's powerful, and that's what Avram wanted to accomplish. And here it is, 3,500 years ago. It still delivers that whole point. And I look forward to for some of the people who are the fellows this year, you know, going with you tomorrow to Machpelah, and you'll experience it yourself, and you'll tell me. And I guess another takeaway is that you see that Judaism cannot. What you see another thing about Chayei Sarah is that Judaism cannot be successful without the woman figure. Avram basically, as far as you look at the rest of the parsha, not much happens for the rest of the 57 or 59 years left of his life. After he did marry again, he had other children with a woman named Keturah, his third wife. But without his life partner and life love, you know, the A-team, they weren't able to deliver the goods. And so much so, we see at the end of the Parsha that Yitzchak himself was very depressed about the loss of Sarah. Not purely because he lost his mother, because everybody's sad when they lose their mother. But lost, sad, feeling sad because that the Jewish people or the proto-Jewish people of that time were rudderless without the female role model. And we don't, you know, in Judaism, without the woman complimenting the man and the man complimenting the woman, the whole thing sort of fails. So, and you know, everybody knows that, you know, behind every successful rabbi is a successful Rebbetzin. You know, I think everybody's experienced that on a personal level, seen that on a personal level. And the ultimate rabbi, the first rabbi in Rebbetzin was Avram and Sarah. And they're the role models of that entire institution. And that's why Avram made a big deal about that, because it just wasn't he lost his wife of 100 years, which of course is tragic, but it was more than just personal. It was civilization. It was a civilizational loss. And that's why he created this entire thing. All right. Any questions about that? Is that clear? Okay. All right, so I want to wish everybody in advance a Shabbat Shalom, Tuesday night, a little early. And we do this every week. The link that I sent out that you received, whether you're an alumni or a fellow, please join us, 8 o'clock Tuesday nights. And we'll be doing this every week. And I think you'll have some material here to have a good Dvar Torah at any Shabbos table you're at. All right, guys, have a great night. And I'll see you guys later. Be well. Bye.